From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of a pre-recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with acclaimed journalist Douglas Murray, author of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Douglas Murray in their conversation.
There's a great danger in leaning heavily on things that you don't know enough about. What it allows, among other things, is for other people to come in and also assert things based on not enough evidence. And this is happening at the moment in the trans debate in particular, where claims are being made about trans, which, like the gay debate, are saying, we know that this is actually what I describe as a hardware issue, a hardware as opposed to software. That is something you can do nothing about. The trans debate has learned from the gay debate and says, we're going to try to do the same thing, which is to show, of course, it's not a choice to be trans. In fact, we're born this way, and there's nothing we can do about it, and that's why you have to give us everything that we want. That's a fascinating move, and you can tell that some of the giveaway signs, among others, are the fact that now, in the trans debate, there is almost no discussion of sexual enjoyment. It's absolutely the other way around. There is an audition to prove that this has nothing to do with sex. And that's a huge giveaway because, of course, it's an attempt to gain advantage based on pretending on that case with the trans one, something we know much less about even than the gay one.
And that train has moved with vast rapidity, plowing down anyone that doesn't adhere to this paradigm.
Well, can I just add to that? I mean, if you watched the Democrat Party's LGBT town hall at the end of last year, there was at least one parent in the crowd with a trans child. Now, I'm very, very uncomfortable about this, the idea there are trans children. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren and the other Democrats were nodding all this along and actually applauding it. And I just watch this and I think, wow. I mean, we have had none of the discussion we would need to have to get anywhere near that kind of certainty.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Something you alluded to earlier that I want to delve into a little more deeply is the initialization of LGBTQ plus, et cetera, the alphabet that you alluded to. When you think about this and when it's developed into an acronym form, so often you suppose that this has to be some kind of a harmonious community and that everyone in the community has the precise same objective. But you point out rightly in the book that this is pure mythology.
Yes, it's the case to some degree with all attempts to group people by characteristics. I mean, I mentioned earlier the disappearance of the class discussion, or at least the diminution of the class discussion. If somebody said to you, I love the working class, I would say, who are you talking about? You know, I can think of some very nice working class friends, and I can think of some people that I don't particularly like. I can think of very smart middle class people and some very dumb ones. Why would you group these people and make a claim just like that? Now, it's even worse when it comes to identity politicking. People say, you know, LGBT people think X. Who are you talking about? Which ones? It's the extraordinary presumptuousness, which we also see with the discussion about women. Women want X. All women? Which ones are you thinking of? And on it goes. Black voters, X. And I think this is just very dangerous in all of these cases because I take a completely opposite view to that, which takes the view that it is the individual that is sovereign in the society and that the individual who is the marker. And that while it's true that identity traits such as your sexuality or sex or race may well have some bearing in your life, to think it is the only signifier of meaning is a profound reduction of what we are as human beings.
This phrase, black and brown people, is used over and over again as though people ought to be characterized by their pigmentation as opposed to being characterized by the content of their character, as Martin Luther King Jr. once put it.
That's right. As you know, in the chapter on race, I cite this as the, I think, probably the most terrifying development of our time. The way in which, over the course of half a century, we've actually completely unwoven and reversed the dream of Dr. King. That central moral insight that he made and gave us half a century ago is being unwoven as we speak and run against in the name of anti-racism by people who profess to be opposed to generalization on skin pigmentation and other characteristics, but who are saying, no, the one thing that matters most is your skin color, your racial origin. And I think this is not just reductive, but profoundly dangerous. It's dangerous in the same way that it's dangerous when people make generalizations against all men, for instance. It has happened in the past with women, and it has happened in the past with people who are black. One of the most fascinating things about our species in the last century or so is our ability to identify a problem, and instead of solving it, to just switch it around and apply the problem in a different direction. So that just as there was a time when some people were allowed to make claims against all women and get away with it, so today people can make allegations against all men and get away with it. In exactly the same way, one century ago, it was possible for people, outrageously, to make wild, sweeping claims about people who were black because of the color of their skin. And today, that is quite rightly viewed as racist and unacceptable. But yet it remains not just acceptable, but actually lauded if people make claims about white people because of their color of their skin. White people are so X. I give example after example in the book, and it alarms me in the same way that the generalizations against the male sex alarms me, because it suggests to me that we are preparing and indeed lining up some horrible return of racial politics.
Yeah, I think the examples that you give in the book are downright terrifying. I want to get back to this rejiggering that's taken place in terms of the gay alphabet. Once the moniker was GLB, and now it's become LGB, and then the other letters TQ, etc. Why has that changed?
Oh, well, it's a slightly boring thing, but what happened was that L was put first because lesbians claimed that they were being marginalized, so it got preference. Gay and bi, it makes sense. Well, as I say, actually, you know, the idea this all goes harmoniously along together in a happy car, as an American comedian put it recently, and that everyone just all gets along in the LGBT car, is not accurate. But it's that last one, the addition of T, that's particularly interesting, which I go into in the last chapter, but also this one Q that has been added. Q for queer gives a very, very big giveaway. You see, I say in the book, I think I'm the first person to have made this point, that there is a difference between gay and queer. Gay is people who happen to be attracted to their own sex. Queer is people who believe that being attracted to their own sex is merely the first stage in some wider political campaign to, for instance, wage war on the patriarchy. It's always the same campaign, by the way. Wage war on the patriarchy and the oppressive white cis heteronormative power structures. You also have people who claim that being queer, as it were, it also means you've got to wage war on capitalism, for instance. And I jokingly say occasionally, well, you know, I didn't get that starter pack. It's the same with some feminism. I mean, I stress in each of these cases, there is extraordinary similarity of what the radicals are really after. There are first and second wave feminists who completely reasonably, decently, and indeed admirably, brilliantly, explained how women needed to be able to be freer in societies like yours and like mine, and how there were definitely sectors of our societies in which they were held back and indeed prejudiced against, and opportunities that weren't open to them. And we all know that from within our lifetimes or just before. There are, however, then feminists who aren't interested in that bit and who say, no, no, no. To be a woman is not to be equal to men, which is how most of us would like simply to view it. Women must use being a woman as simply the first stage in pulling down the oppressive power structures of our time and then, you know, defeating the white, cis, heteronormative, patriarchal power structures and also capitalism along the way. And I think you can see exactly the same thing in what has happened since the civil rights movement, where, again, there are people who argue, no, being black is not just about being equal with being white or any other skin color. Being black is simply the first stage to pulling down the power structures, including capitalism and so on. And I think that it's necessary to identify this and to identify the common things that are going on here, because to do so is, apart from anything else, to try to start to get out of the argument these people are trying to invite us into, which is to view societies like America and Britain as especially unfair, especially in need of some kind of social and economic revolution. And this is an organized campaign by now, an organized social thought being taught and has been taught for more than a generation to young Americans. And it needs to be singled out and critiqued.
Don't go away. We'll be right back and rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Douglas Murray. Many Christians think our culture has gone mad, and they're not alone. Even non-believers who identify as gay recognize this. Although it's clearly not a Christian book, The Madness of Crowds by Douglas Murray, a journalist living an openly gay lifestyle, is a must-read for Christians because it clearly demonstrates how far cultural madness has progressed. While things are certain to get worse before they get better, there is hope, but not if Christians default to a business-as-usual stance. To receive your copy of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org.
In The Madness of Crowds, Douglas Murray examines the most defining and divisive issues of our time, sexuality, gender, technology, and race, revealing the culture wars playing out in our workplaces, universities, schools, and homes in the names of social justice, identity politics, and intersectionality. While Murray is openly gay and not a practicing Christian, his observations about the diabolical imposition of the new morality and metaphysics of identity, gender, and sexuality, and their Marxist undercurrents, resonate with the concerns of Christians. Narrow sets of interests now dominate the agenda as society becomes more and more tribal. Readers of all political persuasions cannot afford to ignore the madness of crowds. To receive your copy of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles that equip you to exercise truth and experience life. Here's what's in the current special double issue of the Christian Research Journal. Dante's Inferno can help explain hell to modern seekers. Counter to our intuitions, Dante depicts sinners as eager to enter the inferno, for hell promises to give them exactly what they want, their sin and themselves forever. Other topics include, did the universe really have a beginning? Christian apologetics in a nutshell. Christianity and the origins of hospitals and modern medicine. The indomitable human spirit of Philip K. Dick. Why arguments over fetal pain capability ultimately miss the mark in the abortion debate, and much, much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition Revised and Updated is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the revised and updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. or visit equip.org. Let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and journalist Douglas Murray as they continue their conversation.
I was very interested to read in your book your quotation of Daniel Mendelsohn. I think the book was called The Elusive Embrace. And in that book, and you have a quotation in that book, I can't recall all of it, but basically Mendelsohn is saying that sex between men dissolves otherness into sameness and concludes that since the object of that knowledge is already wholly known to each of the parties, the act is also redundant. And then he concludes that perhaps that is the reason that so many of us keep seeking repetition as if depth were impossible. That seems to be a scathing analysis of the gay condition, and yet you quote it.
Yes, I quote it. I think it's one of the very few times I've seen somebody who themselves is gay writing about this. I don't entirely agree with the quote. What I'm interested in about it is that it reveals something and speaks to something very interesting. And this really comes, again, across all of the issues I'm writing about in The Madness of Crowds. One of the questions I think is most interesting is the people that I'm running against in this book talk about us as human beings as if we have prejudices and views which can be conquered and got over for all time. Now, one of the things I say at the end of the gay chapter in The Madness of Crowds is, what if there is actually something slightly unnerving about male homosexuality in particular? It doesn't justify bigotry, again, it doesn't justify any kinds of hatred, but to say maybe there are things that people find slightly unnerving, and maybe we just have to accept that that's the case. Let me give you another example. People talk about some men being misogynists. What do we call a man who's had a particularly bitter and unpleasant divorce and as a result has generalizing views that are sour about women and their likelihood of being able to have a successful relationship with them? Do we say that person is a misogynist? And if so, do we pretend as if it's some totally abnormal thing that has happened to them rather than an ugly consequence of an ugly thing that has happened in their lives? And again, doesn't mean it's acceptable or nice to be generalizing about women, doesn't mean they should be derogatory about them, but this happens. Let me flip it around. Let's say there is a black person who has had a horrible experience of racism from a white person. Let's say somebody in their 70s or 80s now who actually, you know, remembers an era where racial relations in America were worse than they are now. If that person actually has an unpleasant suspicion of white people, and even worse, maybe almost a dislike of white people, do we simply call that person a racist and anathematize them? Or do we say it's ugly, it's very unpleasant, they have their own reasons for feeling the way they do, and we wouldn't want other people to feel like that, and we really hope it's not perpetuated. But we don't treat them just like some abnormal alien who got there from nowhere. And I think this points to a really complex and difficult truth, which is this idea that we identify certain human beings as homophobic, transphobic, racist, misogynist isn't quite right. It's not accurate and it's not quite helpful because we're all a bit more complex than that. We all have our own experiences and we fluctuate within our lives. And it seems to me that, funnily enough, this era of celebrating difference and all that sort of thing isn't actually very tolerant of the fact that we are all a bit more complex than we pretend.
Beautifully stated. Let me move on to your first interlude, which has to do with Marxist foundations. I wonder if you can elaborate on the Marxist foundations of identity politics and particularly intersectionality.
One of the things I say that is most interesting in this is that there are very clear substructures we can now identify. One of them is, as I say, the Marxist substructure, which is underneath all of what I'm describing in this book. This isn't to say that everybody who follows this is a Marxist. A lot of people follow it totally unknowingly. But that there is a Marxist interpretation of history and indeed a Marxist interpretation of individuals, which is clearly running underneath a lot of this. It is, among other things, the interpretation of life almost solely through the lens of power. Who has power, how you can acquire it from them, and how it could be more equitably distributed. These are deeply Marxist views to start from, and they have interwoven throughout the intersectionalist version of understanding our societies. There's a lot more. One of them is the point I make that I trace some of the almost unreadable, but nevertheless I had to read them, post-Marxist and neo-Marxist writers from the latter half of the 20th century, who, as communism was falling apart, started to realize that they had to come up with a new way of understanding society. And the way they come up with it is to say, look, the working class in countries like America fundamentally let us down. They never turned up for the revolution in significant enough numbers. So this doesn't mean, and it's always important to remember this, the Marxists never think that failure of their project means that the project is a failure. It simply means that we've got to find a new way to make it work, and it will one day. The people who pushed this in the latter half of the last century go through this by saying, because the working class let us down, we must now look for new client groups. And we must draw on, and they are completely frank about this, and I quote them, we must, for instance, draw on sexual minorities, we must draw on women as a group, and we must draw on racial minorities. And these people, these groupings, will be the new vanguard who will this time successfully bring about the Marxist society that these people would like. As I say, a lot of people, particularly, you know, students who've just unfortunately been indoctrinated on American campuses, don't know this is what they've imbibed. But it's perfectly possible, and we all know examples in the world of ideas, of people who've simply drunk from wells deeper than they know.
What about democratic socialism? Is that an oxymoron?
Well, you would have said so, but you could argue that the history of certain center-left parties across Europe shows that as a term, it means something slightly different than it would mean. I don't want to be too pure philosophically about this, but it meant a particular thing, and it could be argued that it now means something slightly different, which is effectively a form of center-leftist politicking. I'm thinking of parties like those in Germany and elsewhere in the post-war period. Same thing with some Christian socialist parties, you could say, so that today it means something slightly different. But in the proper interpretation of it that one would have had in the past, no, they are very significantly contradictory.
One of the people that you reference in the book, and I think someone that we ought to know a whole lot more about, is Michel Foucault and his predilections to power and contradiction. In fact, one of the things that I found really fascinating in the book is how you expose the predilection to taking words, stringing them together in such a way that if you read them, you think this must be profound, but I have no idea what this writer's talking about. And you're pointing out that this is purposeful.
Yes. My own belief as a writer is that the point of using words is to try to not just get to truths, but also to get to them in a way that makes complex things more easily understandable than they previously were. As a reader, that's something I appreciate in writers, and as a writer, it's something I strive to do. What's interesting is that a lot of the intersectionalist identity politics writers, in fact, all of them, write about really often quite simple ideas and make them sound unnecessarily complex. And that's because they try to sound cleverer than they are, and they try to present very basic misunderstandings as being incredibly complex because it suits their purposes. And among other things, it suits their vanity. Another reason, of course, is that they have nothing to say. And that is the case on occasion. I give examples of that. People who use language so opaque that it's clear that they are hiding the fact there is nothing to say, or where they deliberately use language so complex and knotty that it seems that they're trying to hide something. And that's the case with the variations of these three is the case with almost the entirety of the sort of intersectionalist literature. And if you come at it as I do and say, I'm a fairly well-read, literate person, and I think that this sentence means nothing, whose fault is it, mine or yours? I'm confident enough with American scholar after American scholar to make it clear the problem is theirs, not mine. One does not read Dostoevsky or Vasily Grossman and need to reread a sentence many times over, and even then still be able to make no sense of it. However, Judith Butler and other gender theorists are writing sentences repeatedly that you can read repeatedly and still make no sense. Is this because Judith Butler is revealing truths more complex than Grossman and Dostoevsky? I think not. But it needs to be called out, because I think a lot of people are intellectually bullied effectively by these people and are made to feel like they don't know anything, when the fact is it's the gender theorist who is the culprit.
We've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we will continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with acclaimed journalist Douglas Murray. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you Douglas Murray's book, The Madness of Crowds: Gender, Race, and Identity. Just call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Don't forget, you can also write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
In The Madness of Crowds, Douglas Murray examines the most defining and divisive issues of our time: sexuality, gender, technology, and race, revealing the culture wars playing out in our workplaces, universities, schools, and homes in the names of social justice, identity politics, and intersectionality. While Murray is openly gay and not a practicing Christian, his observations about the diabolical imposition of the new morality and metaphysics of identity, gender, and sexuality, and their Marxist undercurrents, resonate with the concerns of Christians. Narrow sets of interests now dominate the agenda as society becomes more and more tribal. Readers of all political persuasions cannot afford to ignore the madness of crowds. To receive your copy of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.